You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Welcome back to an ongoing series covering the strange situation surrounding Kayla Reid's decision to covertly flee Newfoundland and join Nature Boy, the Costa Rican-based spiritual leader. Before we get into the content of this episode, I'd like to take a moment and step back and remind you of my original motivation in pursuing this topic. I first read the news reports of a missing young woman from my part of Canada and became concerned. But when the follow-up articles indicated she had turned up in a YouTube video and now was living amongst a rumored cult in Costa Rica, I became fascinated and watched along in amazement as the strange story unraveled itself on Facebook, YouTube, and of course in the international news. When Kayla exited the tribe and returned to Canada, the story seemed to meet its conclusion. However, I was left wondering what factors could possibly lead to such a unique situation, and I set out to learn more, and of course I plan to share my findings with you. My first step was to contact Sunray, formerly known as Kayla Reid. That led to the first episode of this series, in which I provided the basic timeline of the events, and of course we were joined by Sunray, who provided insight on the thoughts and feelings that motivated her to make such an unusual journey. Next, I shifted the focus to the controversial spiritual leader Nature Boy and did my best to answer the many questions I had about him. Most significantly, how does a former American male model slash stripper end up leading a spiritual group in the jungles of Costa Rica? During the production of this series, I was able to learn a great deal about Sunray and Nature Boy as individuals, but despite being much closer to understanding them, I'm still left puzzled by what conditions lead to situations like the one found in this story. I went into this topic with only a basic understanding of cults. All I knew of the phenomenon was what I managed to pick up when reading about the most extreme cases, for example, the Manson family, Heaven's Gate, and of course the Jonestown massacre. When researching this case, I realized very early on that the group dynamics and sociological concepts at play were much more nuanced than I had ever imagined. In my quest to better understand this story and others like it, the next step obviously was to consult an expert and ask them to further explain the phenomenon of cults and new religious movements. Fortunately for me, one of the leading experts in this field is a fellow Canadian named Mike Kropfeld. He's the executive director of an organization based out of Montreal called InfoCult, or for the Francophones listening, InfoSect. I knew Mike would be able to remove some of the mysteries surrounding cults and thought he would be able to provide the perfect capstone on this series covering Sunray, Nature Boy, and the Aetherians. When I contacted him, he was happy to answer some of the questions I had. So in tonight's episode, I will share my conversation with a world-renowned expert on cults, new religious movements, and the related phenomenon, Mike Kropfeld. I'll keep the introduction here as brief as possible, as you'll hear Mike and I speak about his personal history in the upcoming piece. But I do need to add some detail. I suspect his modesty leads him to downplay his achievements and contributions to this field of study. Mike Kropfeld has been involved in the topic of cults since the late 70s, when a personal experience occurred which you'll hear him describe shortly. In the years since, he's helped thousands of families affected by this phenomenon. And in addition to working directly with those affected, he's appeared as an expert witness in many cult-related court cases. He serves as a consultant for mental health and law enforcement agencies, and he wrote a highly respected book on the topic. At present day, Mike serves as the executive director for his nonprofit, InfoCult, and is a board member for the International Cultic Studies Association. Mike's even been referred to as the Cult Whisperer, and I think that's a name he lives up to. Now, I know that introduction was a bit long-winded, but I think you get the idea. He's the real deal. I'll play the conversation with Mike Kropfeld now. I, I'd like to start with you. If you could tell me a bit about your background and what exactly led to you to get so heavily involved in cults and all the related phenomenon.
This goes back into the late 1970s when I had a close friend of mine who joined a group called the Unification Church, better known to most people as the Moonies. To make a long story short, the subsequent kind of kidnapping, deprogramming of our friend was written up in a series of articles, now the defunct Montreal Star, and in a book and made into a major motion picture. And the stories that got written up led to a lot of kind of concern on the part of a lot of people who wrote into the journalist asking for more information. For the first time, this was a major story that hit the Canadian media. And so that we ended up responding to a lot of people on a volunteer basis, you know, based on the experience we had and the information that we had picked up dealing with the experience of our close friend. After a couple of years, I became interested in trying to do this more full time because we recognized that there was a need for information and for help on the part of a lot of people. And at that time, most of the people calling were parents about the sons or daughters. And so after a bit of attempts to try to get funding for it, we did get initial funding from the Jewish Community of Montreal, and we started up a project there known as the Cult Project at that time. And we existed there for about 10 years before we became, in 1990, a completely independent organization called InfoCult in English and InfoSect in French, run by a board of individuals, most of them who have knowledge and expertise in this area as well. So we've been around for now close to 40 years. So as I said, it's a long story of how I got involved, but that gives you kind of the short overview.
Yeah. Before InfoCult was launched again about 40 years ago, was there anything like this of its kind in Canada?
There was really nothing of any kind dealing with it. I think there were a couple individuals who were helping people or responding to calls. Overall, there was not much going on. The articles that came out by the journalist Josh Fried, who detailed the experiences that we had with our friend, were the first series of articles in Canada dealing, and it was a series of articles that came out. It was a major story that was picked up by the wire service and beyond Canada as well, but it was the first major story that came out. So there was nothing else at that time that existed. We were the first organization actually that started up.
Yeah, so it was basically just the fact that like your friend was involved, it made the news, so people just naturally went to, you know, to you and the journalists. So you were just kind of, I guess, in the right place at the right time as far as setting up the group.
In terms of timing, yeah, it came at a period, I guess, when the subject or the issue of what we call cults, new religious movements, was in its heyday. And also, I think an important note to point out is the experience we had with our friend was in 1977. We got more involved in the area in 1978 because People's Temple and the mass murder suicides of over 900 people in Jonestown made the world press. And that really kind of resonated with many people who started to see the phenomena as a major issue or concern. And so that also came into play as well.
At this point, again, almost 40 years after you started the group, what type of services is InfoCult providing? And like, what type of activities are you regularly involved in aside from talking to me today?
Media is a part of it. Most of the things we deal with are direct services to people who call for information. And also having certain problems or issues with somebody they're concerned about. So that's one part, and the major part of our activities is dealing by phone and less by internet, just because email is not a very not conducive really to expanding on situations or issues. But a lot of what we deal with is responding to people's concerns about a family or friend situation, but not just from families. It really covers the spectrum. We get calls of inquiries from law enforcement, youth protections, professionals, psychologists, doctors, etc. Very, you know, broad, about a very broad area of concerns about different groups and movements. That's a major part of, let's say, our work. At the same time, as we house one of probably the largest libraries of information in Canada, a unique collection on the subject cults, new religious movements, and related kind of subjects, as well as we are involved with an American organization called the International Cultic Studies Association in organizing international conferences, which are held on opposite years or basically on subsequent years in Europe every 2 years and then in North America. And so that takes up a considerable amount of time. And these are conferences which pull together people from around the world that are concerned about the issue, but also deal with former members, mental health professionals, researchers, and the concerned public around this area.
Now, without getting into particulars, could you just give me an idea of like a typical request you would get like from a family member concerning, you know, cults in your group?
Well, there's two, I guess, that come in often. One of the things that always comes to mind is that probably a large number of our calls start by somebody calling and saying, do you have information about X group? And is it a cult, yes or no? So we get a lot of like yes or no questions that we, and, you know, so that's the number one kind of call we get. And many of them come from families or concerned individuals who have somebody involved and they want to know, what is this group? Ultimately, I think I want to clarify right at the beginning is we don't give yes or no's. We don't deal with yes, it's a cult, no, it's not a cult for a variety of reasons. But a lot of the calls come from people who are concerned usually about someone's involvement or about, you know, a certain group. And more of the calls that we get, which is very different from when we first started, are from people calling because they're checking the group out before thinking of joining.
Oh, interesting.
Which is quite different from when we first started. When we first started, I would say pretty much all the calls we got were people who were calling about somebody in a group and or had left an organization, not checking it out. So that's one of the things that point out is a very positive note over the years is that people have, you know, taken the time now to really kind of do a lot more research and, you know, taking the time to check things out before joining a group.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned your group isn't the info cult, isn't the one who would decide, you know, yes or no, is this a group or is this a cult? But what I find difficult is the actual terminology. Now, I wanted to just ask you kind of a few of the terms and phrases that have come up during my research in this case. The first one is new religious movement. I've never heard of that term used until I started covering Nature Boy and his group, the Aetherians, but now I see new religious movement written all over the place online.
Right.
What exactly is that?
Well, this is one of the problems I think you've alluded to at the beginning of the question is terminology. Terminology in many ways is a hindrance to getting people to understand, let's say, about movements or groups, because often people look at it and say, well, if it's a cult, it's bad. Though, and if it's considered to be a new religious movement, it must be okay. There's no real agreed-upon definition for the term cult. You know, though many people might assume that, you know, they know what a cult is, there really is an agreed-upon definition, and there's no legal definition of it as well. Cults, when we first started, you know, were still seen in a neutral kind of way, not necessarily harmful. That's why many people would classify groups as destructive cults to basically imply that the group is considered to be harmful. But even at that time, there were certain characteristics that people would label, but there was no real definition agreed upon. The same thing with new religious movements. The question is some people would say, well, this is an attempt to make groups that are new look okay. Because if cult makes a group look bad and negative, now we use the term new religious movement to make it seem like it's just a new positive experience. The problem with both of those terms is there's really no standardized kind of definition or use. Like when you talk new religious movement, sometimes there are movements that are brought into that kind of umbrella, which are groups from the 1800s. Some people say, no, you should be looking at groups that are really from the 1960s on or pre, you know, post-Second World War. So there's no agreed upon kind of like, you know, no consensus on, but what do we mean really by those terms? The difficulty is you get people get caught up in kind of what I say, the red herring of trying to look at a movement and saying, is it good or bad? And recognizing that we should be looking at groups, whether it be religious or other, and that's also one of the stumbling blocks with the term new religious movement, it assumes that the groups that we're maybe looking at are all religious in nature, whereas what we do here at our organization is we look at groups. They can be groups that are religious in nature, they can be political, they can be psychotherapeutic, etc., but we're looking more at how do the groups function. And rather than placing groups at opposite ends of the spectrum, like they're good or bad, recognizing that maybe we should be looking at how to place them on a continuum. and the continuum kind of more or less portraying movements that are on one side more open, tolerant, respectful of people, and more democratic versus groups at the other end of the spectrum that are very closed, disrespectful, intolerant, and led by a very strong authoritarian individual. Now, looking at those extremes, most groups will probably fall somewhere in the middle or along the continuum, which makes it more complicated than just saying it's a good group or a bad group, or it's a cult or a new religious movement.
You have cult in the title of your group, InfoCult. Uh-huh. If in the simplest terms, if you had to tell me what a cult is, could you do that, or would you instead explain to me like you just explained the continuum?
I would explain. Well, it was most of what I do when I'm sitting on the phone. I mean, we've had over the last probably 20 years, two significant periods where we looked at changing our name because of the dilemma of how that term is used. Because we've kind of had that in our name for so long, we've ended up coming both times to the conclusion that we're known by that name. Ultimately, when people call us, we take the time, and actually more time, to explain why we don't, you know, do labeling. Because part of the difficulty is, and that's why everybody who calls, the question is, what do you really want to know about the group, and how will that help you? Now, if you're calling because you think you have a loved one in the group, you know, and somebody says to you, well, it's not a cult, does that mean now your concerns should be just disappearing and everything's okay? And usually most people who call say, no, well, I'm concerned about X, Y, Z. Okay, let's look at your concerns. And also recognizing that the terminology you're going to use if you're talking to the person could be a major stumbling block in how you're going to interact and maintain communication with the individual. And from our perspective, a lot of what we work on and believe people should be doing is at minimum maintaining communication, and then how to increase or make, you know, the communication even stronger and work towards a dialogue with individuals rather than, you know, people sometimes feel like, and it's happened. So that's why I'm saying from experience, many people have called and said, you know, my son or daughter or my loved one is in a group, and I told them it was a cult and they're not really talking to me anymore. You know, getting people to understand, you know, in specific situations that things are a bit more complex. And because today the term cult has such a negative image, clearly no one thinks they're joining a cult. So it's kind of a non-statement to make. It's like saying, you know, you fell in love with somebody. And if I was talking to you and you were the person, Jordan, you fell in love, and I'm calling you and say, Jordan, you fell in love with this woman. She's not for you. She's crazy. She's, you know, she's somebody you should drop her right away. Now, the expression is love is blind comes into play, and I think it's applicable when people join different groups because they see things with their eyes. And they're seeing things, you know, and kind of, what do they say, the honeymoon. It's like everything is kind of seems to respond to what they're looking for. And so now you're approaching them saying, what you're looking at, Jordan, is not true. You should stop and leave the relationship. Well, you know, if you thought it was no good for you, you probably wouldn't have gotten in the first place. And all I'm doing is reinforcing the fact that maybe you should say less to me and cut off communication. So that's what I'm saying. When you're looking at what you're saying and how you're saying it, you know, depends on the context and why people are asking. Now, I'm just giving you the example of a family situation. Some people call and say, well, we've got this group that wants to rent space in our building. Now, is it a cult, yes or no? Well, you know, if you're going to refuse, depending on the institution you're in, you're going to have a bit more information than just somebody saying it's a cult or it's not a cult. You know, what is it about the group that allows you to say, no, I'm not going to rent to this organization? So each situation, I think, is different in terms of, you know, how you want to handle it, and also, therefore, you know, how an organization like ours responds to, like, simple questions. And very simply, we don't respond to simple yes or no questions.
Because there's much more to it than that, as I say now.
In most cases, there are. And it's, you know, really, you know, when you start digging into different cases, you know, you're dealing with human beings. You know, human beings are complex individuals, complex. And so the situations they're going to get into are more than likely to be complex. So, you know, simple yes or no's are not going to resolve it. So it's really looking, and that's what takes a lot of our time when we deal with people, is, okay, what's going on? How can we help you? Here's certain ideas or approaches. You know, what are you hoping to achieve? Now, is your goal practical or, you know, feasible? If it's not feasible, then maybe you should be looking at other approaches or other ideas. There's no question that what we deal with, and I think Glenn underlined that too, is there are groups out there that do harm people, and their people are harmed. But the question ultimately is in individual situations, you know, what are you hoping to achieve and what do you want to do? And usually, to say the least, having a simple yes or no or cult yes or no is not going to resolve the problem.
Now, you mentioned when you were defining, and I'll put air quotes on cult or dangerous group,
yes.
they often will have an authoritative leader. Is that would be considered a common characteristic of these dangerous groups?
Well, when we're not looking so much at danger, you're looking at the question of the potential or the risk. You know, in our opinion, if you're looking at movements which are run by authoritarian leadership, the potential risk for people involved or, you know, those around it is heightened. This does not mean just because you have an authoritarian leader that you can assume that the group is going to be a problem or dangerous. All you have initially is, well, we have a very strong authoritarian leader. Now, what is he doing? What is he saying? How does the group function? You know, what is the belief of the organization? What is their interaction with society? When you're talking about control or authoritarianism of the leadership, what is he dictating to his members? You know, what do people have to follow? What do they have to believe? You know, in other words, what are the rules and regulations of the organization? So as to better evaluate, okay, what's really going on?
And do you look into, like with the different groups with these authoritative leaders, do you think of different look into different characteristics they would have in common? Like, is there a certain person that finds himself in that position?
Well, some people would say that, you know, they're narcissistic personalities. I mean, I tend to look at the fact that just like, you know, these groups appeal to a wide range of people, I think you'll have leaderships that will also have, you know, leaders that will also have a wide range of personalities, as well as looking at groups that evolve over time, where the group, in a sense, reinforces the power and position of the leader, who ends up taking more and more power as well.
Interesting.
And I think there's a certain kind of, you know, if you're looking at certain movements, you look at, in many cases, there's an evolution. You know, some groups do not start out as very extreme, but become more extreme over time as the leader obtains and is given more and more. And when I say given, so often it's indirectly given more and more power, because people come to view the individual as someone who has the potential to help them change their lives, or has some kind of magical recipe to helping them, society, the world.
Now, as far as the people who would be prone to join a possibly harmful group, or any group in general, is there common characteristics or personality traits for the people who would be more susceptible to, you know, fall under the spell of some of these people?
I would say at the outset, anybody's potentially vulnerable. When you're more vulnerable to falling into a situation of pretty much any group, which can be harmful at some point, is those who are going through, let's say, stressful times in their life, breakup in a relationship, some kind of transition. There's a death of a loved one. You know, may have lost your job or just failed at school. You know, looking for meaning in your life, the need to believe or belong in something. These are things that make you more, let's say, open to either being approached by someone or you're looking for something. But since, you know, some of these kind of characteristics can apply to everyone at a certain point in their life, one can say to a degree that anybody is potentially vulnerable at a certain period where you become more open to wanting to believe that there's something out there that will resolve the conflict, the difficulties that you may be going through. Or at the same time, maybe an existential kind of desire to, I need to believe or belong in something. I want to help change the world. And so in many ways, I'd say you're getting people who are also have very positive characteristics, very positive attributes, where they want to do something positive.
And now, when I first began reading about and researching Kayla Reid's situation from Newfoundland, I think I was ignorant to how, you know, how common cults are and this sort of thing is. On one hand, I could count the amount of times I've heard stories like this set in Canada, but I'm sure you'll have a different perspective. How common would you say it is for people to be affected by this phenomenon in Canada? Like, is this happening every day?
The question of common is always a difficult, the same way that I always have a hard time when people ask how many members, you know, and how many people are affected. The numbers, I think, are very difficult, because it always comes down to what are you defining. So leaving aside the term cult, are there issues where people are concerned about the involvement in groups that goes on, yeah, I pretty much say daily. How common is it across the country? That's really hard to say. You know, some people have claimed there are thousands of different cult groups around. I don't think that's really the case. I think many times the term is applied to movements which are just simply groups that people don't know much about but seem different or strange, or are evaluated from not just a kind of a behavioral approach, but also from a theological approach, which then changes also the dynamics. Because if you're looking at movements from a theological approach, that's very different from looking at it from a behavioral. So that for some people, they may consider the group harmful because it's theologically heretical. We tend to look at groups and try to evaluate how do they function, you know, irrespective of what they believe.
And now, during your time being involved in this, again, roughly just going on 40 years, can you just tell me some examples of the more notable, again, air quotes, cults or dangerous groups that existed in Canada?
The groups that have come up in Canada, for sure, that have been, like, you know, labeled very simply, like with the term cult, there's two that come to mind right off the bat. That's a group that was led by this individual called Rock Moses Thériault, which was known more, I'd say, in Quebec, because of the brutal treatment of a lot of its members and kids as well. They were functioned for a lot of years here in Quebec, but then subsequently moved to Ontario. He was kind of, let's say, better known for the fact that he, and the story that I think probably got a lot of attention across the country, is for his belief in the fact that he was kind of like capable of curing and healing people, and he amputated one of the members' arms. And she was the one that later on kind of alerted police and youth protection to the problem in that organization. That was a group that was very well known, as well as one of the major ones in stories in Canada was the Order of the Solar Temple, which also, let's say, happened in Quebec, where there was people who died, not just in Quebec, but also in France and in Switzerland. There was a mass kind of, I'd say, murder, suicide as well that went on in that time. Those are kind of a couple of major Quebec examples that got kind of, let's say, countrywide recognition. What is happening now in terms of the area of concern, obviously, is one case is going on presently in British Columbia is a case of a suit against a couple of polygamist leaders. So there's a couple of the more well-known ones. And there's always been cases that have popped up throughout the country that have been labeled as, let's say, cultic. But also, I think it's important to recognize that you're looking at situations which may get labeled as cults or not, but are situations that are that pretty much touch most of the country.
Now, with Kayla Reed's story, and again, that's what brought me into this, is that definitely got coverage, and I think that even received international coverage. Were you involved in her story at all as this was happening?
Not other than being interviewed for, I think I was approached by a journalist about the story. But I don't have enough information on it. I mean, I watched, I saw some of the interviews, but in terms of direct involvement, no. Other than just to be interviewed for a story that came out in thing in a paper, and also kind of surprised by the extent of the coverage of this story, when on one level there seemed to be not extensive information known about what was going on. And to be honest, there was a lot of, like, you know, reading between the lines where I felt there was a lot of information that was missing. If I was wanting to look at this more closely, I'd want to have a lot more questions answered before even attempting to pronounce on it, this movement.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the reason it was covered so much, and it definitely why I reacted to it so strongly, I guess, is it just seemed like such an unusual event, like to see, you know, a young girl from my part of the world, and she's from Newfoundland, ending up in Costa Rica after being reported missing. Like, it just seems like such a wild story and an unusual story. Like, when you first heard this, did this surprise you? Did this seem like, you know, a really strange thing, or would this be kind of in line with what you deal with?
Well, it happened. I'm aware of situations like that. What I'm not aware of is that many that where it goes public. Because often in situations where a family, you know, knows where someone is, you know, I mean, initially it sounded like they didn't know where she was. So, yes, I can understand going public. But once you kind of know where someone is, most of the cases I get, people kind of either know where someone is or feel that they've disappeared. They don't necessarily go public, which is very understandable, because we get a lot of calls, and I can understand where the concern and worry of, you know, families comes into play. And if they view what their loved one is involved with is potentially a dangerous group, it's not a surprise that they're going to go that route. You know, is it the most efficient, effective way to deal with it? Well, that's another question. I don't have any, you know, details to basically, you know, take a position on that.
In this case, Kayla had left Newfoundland and is now in Costa Rica with a group which may or may not be, you know, harmful or dangerous. But if you're the family and you want to get your loved one back, what options, like, do you have? If someone's an adult, it seems like there's not a lot you can do to, you know, to compel them to return home. Are you involved in situations like this where you're trying to, you know, yeah, weigh options? And could you just talk through, like, things you would be considering?
Well, part of it is you start off with the fact that the person is an adult. You know, they're going to make their own choice. If the thing that you want to at least see, and that's where it depends on whether or not a family has contact with the individual or no contact. Because if you have contact, what I say, that gives you an opening to at least, you know, keep the communication going and find out more about what's happening with the person. If you have no contact, then the question is, how do you establish or find mechanisms to communicate with the individual in the group? When you don't have communication, when things are totally cut off, it becomes more understandable why people would go to a more extreme kind of, let's say, option of going public or doing something more dramatic, is because they feel they often have nothing to lose. So before going that route, I'd say let's look at all the other options that may be possible of finding how to attempt to communicate. Legally, it depends on, like, you know, you can look at what the legal rights are of the person to be there or not be there. And obviously, if they overstay their welcome, can you call immigration? And depending on the country they're in, that may be an option. The question you have to look at with any option, what's the potential blowback? Now, if the individual is not, you know, kicked out of the country, you know, does that mean they're going to completely cut off contact with their family? If they are returned or kicked out of the country, what are they returning to? And what would stop them from going back into the group? So you got to look at these kind of things at the same time as what is actually going on. What do you really know? And what is the process that has led that individual to get involved in that group? As well as I mentioned, you know, what do we know about that group? So that'll help in terms of figuring out how do we approach it. But the basic, you know, importance is if you have contact, is how do you maintain it, and kind of looking at what not to do and what to do in situations like that.
It almost sounds like you're describing like a hostage or a hostage negotiation, but your loved one maybe is putting themselves in the position to become a hostage.
Well, possibly, but the thing you want to focus on in that context is you want to deal with the person. You do not want to necessarily go after the leader. Initially, I was talking about the love relationship. Now, if I'm dealing with you because I'm concerned that you're in a relationship with somebody, do I want to sit there and tell you how bad that person is for you? Or do I want to focus on and say, look, I'm concerned because I don't understand exactly what's happening here and what has led you to make this kind of a decision? It's basically, you don't have to like what someone's doing, but ultimately, it's helpful to try to understand or see the situation through the eyes of the individual. Because they're going to react or respond based on how they see things, not how you see it. And so basically trying to say to somebody, you're in a cult, it's no good for you, you should leave, blah, 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 is highly unlikely to work. You know, it's more likely to encourage or reinforce their conviction to stay. Because if they're there, it's because they view things in a very positive light. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. You know, it's very rare that people are going to be in situations where they can't get out physically. Most of the groups that people join is more a psychological, emotional kind of connection that people develop, which gets them to stay, or they have some kind of a spiritual experience and that kind of reinforces their conviction to maintain their adherence to the movement.
Now, as much as you know about Nature Boy and his group Etherians, would, again, knowing that you haven't gotten deep into this case, but does this seem like it has the makings of a, you know, a dangerous or possibly harmful group?
That's like a hypothetical. You know, are you going to walk out of your house tonight and get hit up by a car? Maybe, depending if you step in the wrong place. That's really hard because movements can kind of move into different directions. Would it intrigue me if I was looking to look further into it? You know, if I was doing the research, yeah. You know, is there some potential there Yeah, but what kind of potential? I mean, you'd want to look at how does the group function? You know, what's going on now? How does it operate? You know, does he really have a leadership role? What kind of leadership role does he have in terms of who makes rules, regulations, or is it more kind of a communal kind of situation where it's much more like loose in terms of how it functions? I mean, I don't have the answers, but I, you know, would be very hesitant to qualify any group as like, oh, I'm concerned because it's going to be dangerous. You know, without having, let's say, sufficient information to back that up. Because hypothetically, you can say there's a risk with any kind of situation, but that is, you know, without, you know, really having anything to back it up other than the reality that anything can potentially become harmful.
One thing I find, I guess, unique or at least interesting about Nature Boy and his group is their willingness and the way they use social media to spread their message and possibly to be, he uses it to recruit new members. When I think of a cult leader or a cult, I'm picturing someone who's, you know, standing on the a busy intersection in New York holding up a sign about, you know, their way they found God or whatever, trying to recruit people that way. But in his case, he's, you know, really clever and people like him and he's on, you know, Facebook and YouTube. It just seems like the internet must have had a huge effect on the way these types of groups grow and operate. Can you just talk a bit about how internet has changed things since, you know, since the 80s when you got involved?
Oh, it's changed dramatically. I mean, there's many groups that do a lot of kind of like media work to, let's say, connect to people. There are even certain groups in quotation marks that are not even functional groups in the sense of people don't get together. They're all connected via the web. Exactly. Podcasts, you know, YouTube videos, you know, material that they can buy. So you have that. I think it's, reality is like many people, you know, use the web. It's not even, let's say, necessarily in a negative way. There are people who are closed in, you know, and shut-ins in their house. So they connect up to a church via the web. So they're, you know, virtually kind of going to a service, but they're physically not present. So the web is a factor. There's many groups that are springing up that are basically web-based, you know, and hard to know exactly what they really all are. But there's a number of these. So the web is not a surprise to see how it's used because there's a way to get a message globally. It kind of reminds me, now, when I first started, people would write books on their personal experience. Now, you're coming out of a group, you write your book, and maybe if you're lucky, you sell a few hundred copies, and that would be it. Today, what do people do? They publish their experience on the web, and it's accessible globally. And so it's no surprise that the web is, you know, the future for many groups in terms of not only recruiting, but also maintaining membership. And this is like in a very, not necessarily just good or bad, but the reality. Because you've got all kinds of movements, the same way you've got all kinds of beliefs that are espoused on the web. People can find whatever they want that will confirm their own views and beliefs. And you can find it on the net. So you can become part of a virtual group, you know, without necessarily ever having to physically meet people. But you can buy into and then become extreme in whatever belief it may be. An area we're getting calls about are from family and friends who find that, you know, loved ones are buying into, in quotation marks, conspiracy theories and becoming extremely, you know, kind of strong, extreme believers in certain kind of ideas and points of view, which are not necessarily supportable by fact, but are getting their information from just specific sites because they're only looking for sites and information that confirm their own point of view. So you're seeing this kind of broad area springing up, and it's becoming, I guess, another challenge for those who are trying to deal with situations where there are problems that happen.
Yeah, and I even went, like, getting into Nature Boy's story when I was researching it and reading about it and watching his videos online, I was shocked to see how many people were doing the sort of thing he was doing on YouTube, which is just basically sitting in front of a laptop just talking about how they see spirituality or whatnot. And if you look at the amount of views and likes and all this, there's a huge, like, a collection of people sitting there on YouTube, you know, absorbing this. Like, are you seeing, does the trend seem to be pointing to an increase in this type of problem that people come to your group for?
Well, I'm very reluctant to talk about numbers unless I could qualify, you know, my actual statistics, but it's a concern that does come up. I mean, clearly, I think when you're seeing more and more of these individuals, and you've got some of these local, let's say, even like pastors as well, that are just putting stuff out on YouTube. The difficulty and the concern, I guess, is the ability for people to critically evaluate what they're seeing and not jumping in head over heels into it. And where can it lead? I mean, obviously, in some cases, it can be something that can be very positive for the individual. But the other side is it can be potentially harmful, too. You know, the point it has to look at, is there, you know, also a financial commitment that one has to make? Is there an emotional, psychological, you know, commitment that one is making as well? Does it change, you know, who you are, and in what direction does it change you? You become a much more, let's say, open, compassionate, caring person, or a much more intolerant, closed individual. Not to say that you don't have the right to become intolerant and closed, but as a society, then you become the larger question is, like, how do we as a society address those kind of concerns? Now, but I do want to come back always to the fact that we deal with a lot of situations where people are hurt. People who come out of groups who've been involved maybe 20, 30 years, were born and raised in them, and with no ability or very limited ability to really kind of function outside the organization, who have an incredible amount of needs, you know, psychological, financial, you know, needs when they come out. And that's their reality, that there are groups where people are being harmed. The difficulty is people, I think, often looking for just simple good or bad, whereas recognizing that people are being harmed in certain environments and groups, and that there is a need for, I think, in our opinion, more services for these people.
And now for anyone who's listening to this show that may feel like they have a friend or loved one that may be in the process of being drawn in, you know, in too closely by a group, where should they start in, you know, in addressing it?
Well, I mean, definitely you can call or check our website out and call us if you want. I think ultimately what we say when people are looking for information about a group, you want to look as many sources as possible. And don't forget to look at the group's own information if they have, let's say, a website or written, you know, publications. You want to get as much information as possible to know about the group, including the person you're concerned about. I don't think you want to avoid the person you're concerned about, but I'm saying at the same time, when you're dealing with an individual in a group or you're concerned about who's joining a group, each case is different. And it's important, I think, to come back to a kind of common refrain I have, is how do you keep the lines of communication open? How do you not get into a situation where, you know, you're stating positions which may unfortunately cause the person to withdraw further into what they're thinking of joining, or further into the group that they're already joined? And also just think about what you want to do or say before you proceed. Look at the pros of your approach, but look at the cons as well, because most people can live with things when they work out the way they want. But the question is, if it doesn't work out the way you want, can you live with that result? So it's thinking about what you want to do and recognizing that most cases are not going to be dealt with simply. It's a process, the same way the person probably, you know, it was a process of them getting involved in the group. Dealing with their situation will also be a process on the part of family or others dealing with somebody in. And it's not like a lot of times, you know, people think of this issue and they think about parents calling about their kids, their son or daughter. Most of the calls we get now, which is very different from when we first started, is often a husband about their wife, wife about their husband, people calling about their parents, grandparents calling about their children and grandchildren. So it's really kind of broadened the family's kind of scenarios from when we first started in the 70s.
And now for people out there who want to learn more about you and your group, where can they go?
Infocult.org is infocult.org. And there's a fair amount of information. We try to be as transparent as possible. So there's a lot of information about our organization on there, annual reports, financial statements, publications that we've, you know, put out, and how people can access us, or, you know, information that we have here. As I said, we have a very large collection of information. Most of it is not on the web just because of the nature of the information and that we possess, but it's accessible, you know, through other means.
To say I learned a lot from Mike would be an understatement. After speaking with him, I have a completely different view on the topic of cults. I mean groups. The biggest thing I'm taking away from this is that cults aren't really a thing. People are complicated, and groups of people, perhaps even more so. I want to thank Mike for sharing his knowledge with me, and I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning into this series covering Sun Ray and Nature Boy. If anything interesting happens in the future, I may revisit this topic, but next I'm on to something new and equally interesting. And with that, we'll conclude this episode of the Nighttime Podcast. If you're interested in hearing more content, please check out the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to my monthly bonus content. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. On behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's current patrons and welcome the newest members to the group: Molly, Belinda, Lauren, Jennifer, Thomas, Jay from Vanishing Gates, Carrie, Mrs. Morby, and my fellow UFO nut, Mr. Newman, and of course, Christy Lee, host of my current podcast obsession, which you should all subscribe to, the Canadian True Crime Podcast. Without you all, the production of this show would be impossible. And again, check out the Canadian True Crime Podcast. I'm a guest actor on her latest series, and I play one of Canada's worst people. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on whichever podcast platform you prefer. To stay up to date, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I use the handle @NighttimePod. If you have any story ideas or some feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep looking around and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
Planet Earth about to be recycled. Your only chance to evacuate is to leave with us.